Alderow.
Swinton.
Here.
Aaron. Brand.
Here.
Madlin.
Here.
McDonald.
Here.
Clark.
Here.
Rodriguez.
Here.
Schoolcraft.
Right.
Here, quorum is present. It's the intention of the chair to lay out all the bills and resolutions relating to the subject of AIDS or blood services. In addition, we would ask that witnesses, when they testify on all the bills rather than coming back piecemeal to address the bills one by one. We'd also ask the witnesses to avoid being redundant. We have quite a few witness affirmations, and we would like to hear from everyone who wants to be heard, but we don't want to hear the same thing twice. So if it's been said, don't say it again. And if you can say it briefly, we'd rather have you say it briefly. Chair lays out HB 235, HB 849, HB 915, HB 1069, HB 1113, HB 1375, HB 1708, HB 1901, HB 2022, HB 2026, HB 2128, HB 2129, HB 2213, HB 2251, HB 2357, HB 2426. HCR 156 and HCR 158. It's the intention of the chair to have the House authors of these bills present their bills initially. We will then try and take testimony alternating between proponents and opponents. We will, to the extent we can, try and accommodate people's travel schedules and airline reservations, but I imagine that's going to be difficult. If you do have specific travel needs, you may want to give those to us at the first break. Chair recognizes Dr. McKinney. Dr. McKinney, you can talk about 1901 or 1901 and anything else that you care to comment on.
I'll talk generically. Of course, you know that we had an interim task force on AIDS, and you'll hear from the chair of that committee in a little while. After a number of hearings, we tried to get together and design a bill that would best address the recommendations of this task force. This is the bill that's before you, 1901. We have a substitute, and I'm not sure whether I'll talk to the substitute. I'm not sure whether y'all passed out copies of it or not.
Do we have the substitute?
Ollie, did they get the substitute? Should have had the substitute to 1901. In fact, it's probably
the
second.
Fine. Let's go ahead and
it's the second rewrite of the substitute. As a matter of fact, that's what they'll go get them and bring them to. Speaking to the substitute. It's not much different than the original bill that you were given. This is about the third or fourth rewrite of the bill. You'll notice that the authors are McKinney, McDonald, and Clemens. And for the committee's sake, you know that's no small accomplishment right there. The bill was as tightly drawn as possible. It is also drawn with the impact of looking at what we could do, avoiding inflammatory language and avoiding things that were unnecessary, still trying to address the issue. Briefly, what it does, it establishes the health department as the primary resource for HIV education, prevention, information, and establishes a number of models under the health department. Number one, workplace guidelines as a model, model counseling and testing programs, and then model educational programs. establishes the health department as the basis for, as the center for a state grant program for nonprofit community organizations, an HIV medication grant program, and establishes a voluntary testing and counseling programs, number one, in each public health region, number two, in state-funded primary health care clinics and in female reproduction clinics. It also has the health department serve as the agency to collect statistics and do epidemiologic projections. The bill relates to a number of state agencies requiring all state agencies to have an annual educational pamphlet in regards to HIV infection. All new employees will receive a pamphlet at the time of initial employment. Agencies are required to adopt the model workplace guidelines that are established by the health department and to adopt some confidentiality guidelines for medical records in keeping with current law, and also allowed are required for the payment of testing of employees who are exposed to HIV infection on the job. This is to be paid through the workers' comp system. Sets up a demonstration project. One of the interesting things of the bill is it sets up a nursing care demonstration project to determine the true cost and how it would best fit into the establishment of nursing home programs. It sets up a demonstration project to determine that. The bill also specifies an offense of intentionally exposing another to HIV infection or to AIDS. Does it under section 22.01, 22.02, and 19.02, which is assault, essentially. The bill would require in-service training for teachers and administrators in public schools. And in exchange for this in-service training in regards to HIV, its infection, transmission, and prevention, they would be given access to the medical records of their students, only in exchange for completion of this program. Again, something that was agreed at after some negotiation with no small dissension from both sides, I might add. It requires the institutions of higher education to have a policy on HIV infection and to present those policies in the student and in personnel handbooks, make them widely known. Establishes a partner notification program, which is voluntary. Requires informed consent, and this is one that I'll let Billy probably explain to you, and the informed consent may need to come out. It's my opinion that there's no such thing as uninformed consent. I think that's an oxymoron, but it requires informed consent for testing. There's a section for disqualification from unemployment benefits. If, number one, you're fired for refusing to provide services within the scope of your job to somebody with HIV infection, or number two, if you quit because you don't want to do that, that you'd be disqualified from receiving unemployment benefits. And also it has the realtor language that's in Deborah Danberg's bill that y'all heard weeks ago. I guess it came through this committee, I don't know. Anyway, Deborah Danberg's bill. But it says that the realtor may not reveal and cannot be required to reveal HIV status of the former residents. It's a relatively thick bill. It's not near as bad as it was when we started. It's not near as thick as it was when we started. And it is not a panacea, but it does offer a solution to a number of the problems. And with that, I'll attempt to answer any questions or wait till later.
Are there any questions, members? Dr. McKinney, do you have a particular order that you would like us to call witnesses? We're going to, just because we have to start somewhere, we're going to start with the people who have filled out witness affirmations on 1901 and ask that all that those people, when we call them, will be addressing that bill. If you want to give us some direction, you might come up and let Jamie know.
The only thing, if Billy or Nancy, either one, if they want to make a statement about the bill, because they're on there too, or if not, Chris Steele, who is the chair of the committee, I would like for her to come.
Well, we will call Chris Steele first, then after we have given all the authors an opportunity to discuss their bills. Mr. Rep here? It's before the committee, and we'll work from the substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I could just discuss quickly both HB 235 and 2213. They're related bills. Technological advances in blood screening tests and the purification process of the clotting factor have rendered the nation's blood supply as safe as it has ever been. But this does not imply that it is completely free of risk. The most significant complications of blood transfusions are immunologic reactions and the transmission of infective disease agents, including the transmission of HIV. While donor screening procedures combined with pre-transfusion laboratory tests can reduce the incidence of the transmission of diseases such as hepatitis, syphilis, malaria, and HIV, they cannot eliminate the risk. The surest preventive measure with regard to the blood supply is to eliminate the exposure of a patient to the blood of others wherever possible. That's from the President's report on human immunodeficiency virus epidemic. But the next securest measure is for the patient to receive blood from a designated donor. House Bill 235 allows a person who requires a blood transfusion to request to receive the transfusion from the blood of a donor designated by the person. That's simply the whole intent of 235. 2213 just approaches it from a different point of view, and just to help secure the blood supply, it would make it an offense to knowingly falsify the application when the questionnaire when you give blood. Those two attempts are just to bring about a tighter control of the blood transfusion methods.
Are there any questions of Mr. Rep? Thank you very much. Mr. Oakley? Mr. Clemens, you want to tell us about 915 and 2357?
Members, House Bill 915 is the bill which would allow testing of defendants convicted of certain offenses, those offenses being sexual acts where body fluid is exchanged. They're specifically named in Section B, starting on line 20. And we create a penalty for knowingly spreading the disease, or HIV. I don't know. 2357 is the bill which would allow emergency personnel such as EMS or firefighters, law enforcement, so on, to request an HIV test whenever they're accidentally or intentionally exposed to body fluids and do not know whether or not that person would be positive or not. It would allow them to receive request that person that they treated be tested for HIV. So,
any questions of Mr. Clemens? Ms. Guerrero?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. House Bill 1069 before you addresses the issue of discrimination. As you know, AIDS is not a moral issue, but a very costly public health problem. As a consequence, you know that we rank fifth in the nation of cases of AIDS, with about 2,500 cases diagnosed since the last session. It's projected that by the year 1992, one in 10 Americans with AIDS will be Texans. What you also know is that this disease doesn't discriminate on the basis of sex or color, social status, sexual orientation. I submit to you that as a consequence, we shouldn't discriminate against people with AIDS on the basis of where they live, or their jobs, or their accessibility to public facilities, or governmental services. The Task Force on AIDS reported extensively on the nature of this problem, and I'll share some with you. 15% of the 434 people surveyed reported that they had lost their jobs. 9% of those lost their housing due solely to discrimination. 53% of those who lost their jobs wanted to return to work. You know the virus is not transmitted through any type of casual contact, but people have been denied employment, insurance, housing, education, and health care because of this disease. But what does this mean to us? Why should we be concerned? Realistically, we should be concerned not just because it's a detriment and a hardship to individual lives, but also because discrimination causes indeed a shift of burden in the financial burden to the state of Texas. Discrimination forces a significant portion of our labor force to become indigent and to rely on public assistance. The impact of the direct cost of medical care and indirect cost of lost wages due to discrimination can be translated into almost $200 million to the state in 1988. This is the low end of the estimation, but it could cost us up to $272.7 million, and it's estimated that this cost could go up to $1.1 billion in 1992. Tell you very simply what this bill does. It provides protection from discrimination for those people who have AIDS, HIV infection, or ARC, and for their caregivers. It prohibits employers from discriminating against a qualified individual. It also prohibits retaliation against a person who has opposed the discriminatory practice. It requires that a person denying any of these services to otherwise qualified individuals must show that no reasonable accommodation can be made to prevent other individuals from being exposed to the significant possibility of being infected with HIV. It provides for private right of action for civil penalties of $1,000 or actual damages and reasonable attorney's fees, and it allows that additional relief can be awarded to the court. Members, some people, I guess, will tell you that we don't need this, that it's being done elsewhere. I'd say to you that the Texas Human Rights Code is designed to prevent employment discrimination, but it does not provide protection for people with HIV infection or their caregivers. Some will tell you the Human Resources Code is provided. It's designed to prevent discrimination in housing and public facilities, but it doesn't provide for people with HIV, AIDS, or other caregivers. Some will say federal laws prevent discrimination in facilities that receives federal funding, but this doesn't apply to non-federally funded institutions. In all, members, 1069 is designed to expand anti-discrimination protection to include the full range of HIV-related impairment. Happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions, members? Thank you very much.
I got one.
Mr. Clement.
Lana?
Yes, sir.
What is perceived as having AIDS mean?
See if I can go through this with you. There's a expanded definition of disability. I guess that's the best description of this. It tracks the federal rehabilitation definition. It has three legs to the issue. I may need some help from somebody, but one is that you have a history of the case. The other is that you have the disease, and the third is that you are perceived to have it. Okay, and the biggest problem with it, of course, is the actual perception of people think there's something wrong with you. They think they know how it's going to affect everybody else, and so the issue of perception is important in that case. The Human Rights Commission code is under sunset review, as you know, and the Sunset Commission has unanimously recommended that we expand the definition in that particular code to include perception as the third part of the definition. It tracks federal Rehabilitation Act definition of disability.
Any other questions, members? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Stanberg.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. While I'm up here, I guess I'll discuss House Bill 1113 and 1708, although that takes it one out of order, if that pleases the Chair. And before I do, real quickly, Dr. McKinney earlier was saying that y'all had heard the real estate AIDS bill, but that bill, which is on the real estate priority list, the realtor's priority list, was heard in business and commerce, but it's nevertheless part of the omnibus bill that's before you. The resource witnesses who are here, I think 1708 is self-explanatory, but if y'all have any questions later on 1113, we have Michael Matthews, who's the president of the PWA Coalition, which is Persons with AIDS Coalition, and Dr. King Hillier, who's with the Harris County Hospital District. First, on 1113, this allows individuals with an income below an amount established by the Board of Health to receive grants for AIDS medication. The department may accept and use local, state, and federal funds and private donations to fund the program. The hospital district may participate in the program by sending district funds to the department, to the health department, for the purpose of providing direct grants to residents of the district for the purchase of AIDS medication. And the district may send funds obtained from any source, including taxes levied by that hospital district. Briefly, members, this, let me draw your attention to the fiscal note on this. This fiscal note was calculated by figuring AZT money, which, as you know, is a very expensive drug, and calculated with, when we were discussing this in the Appropriations Committee, on which I serve, the way this was calculated was by figuring how it would, what it would cost if you maximized the program to all people who needed it and fully funded it. The bill is drafted in such a way that it allows flexibility so that if there were no funding, it would still be an important bill to pass because of several different points. And what we've done as far as how to determine the full funding of it is if the appropriations bill passes as expected, it'll be funded at a certain level, and then the way they would decrease that if the money was not there would be to use an income eligibility as you use in so many other public health services. The hospital districts still need this because by buying medications through the state, they'll be able to buy in bulk and it'll save money for the hospital districts and lower the local taxpayer burden. Additionally, it will allow the hospital districts to use local money to get federal matching money. And as I'm sure this committee is painfully aware, Texas is one of the worst at getting our federal money back. We send off, for every dollar we send off, I'm the speaker's representative on the Health and Human Services Coordinating Council, by the governor and lieutenant governor and speaker, as you know, trying to lower medical costs in great part. We have found that our state is one of the very worst at getting federal money back. For every dollar we send, we get back around 90 cents, whereas California, for example, gets back $2.23 for their federal money. So this will allow us to use local money to get federal matching money and get some of that money back. Additionally, this will save money because it will keep people out of the hospital and allow for flexibility to buy the newest and latest technology of drugs, as I'm sure Representative Clemens and I think Nancy, Representative McDonald on your committee can tell you from their hearings. Just using the AZT example, without having AZT availability, the cost is 10 times as much in acute hospital care because the average person with AIDS has 3 hospital visits per year, averaging 10 days. And if you calculate that out, that, you know, the factor of 10 times the cost to the state agencies once these people become indigent, lose their jobs, go on welfare, and so on, is quite high. And that's just calculating hospital costs. That's not counting the fact that they're not tax-paying employed citizens anymore. So this is a bill that I think hopefully you'll find is a big money saver and allows a lot more flexibility and cost effectiveness in our purchasing. Should I ask for questions on that one now, Chairman, and then go to the other one?
Mr. Clemens.
Deborah, on Section 2, AIDS Medication Grant Program, wouldn't it be more palatable or a better program if it just eliminated the word AIDS and just said Medicaid Grant Program? Because really we want to do this for everybody that's terminally ill, don't we? It says the program should provide grants for individuals and so that we can reduce hospitalization, improve the quality and longevity of patients' life.
I'm familiar with this from the end of serving on the Appropriations Committee, and this is the area that we funded through that. I'm not sure how the implications would be on the fiscal note, what kinds of frameworks are set up, generalized funding on this. So you'll allow me to research this with the Legislative Budget Board and get an answer to you. I can be more specific.
I think you'd probably agree with me on it, just that we're trying to address this particular thing now, but I'm just...
This is the one that's breaking your local taxpayers' backs.
Starting on line 18, on the first page, persons involved in the treatment, care, or counseling of individuals with AIDS, does that mean we'd make the grants directly to, say, some private organizations? Or since a person is any legal entity, would that only be like a county hospital or something government entity?
The board will set the rules for that under the terms of the bill and as is currently their
In other words, the bill doesn't propose that we make grants to organizations that are not audited by the state or that hire lobbyists or have political agendas of their own, that sort of thing. Is that correct?
The bill makes it occur through a state agency, which is the Department of Health.
Good.
Mr. Schoolcraft?
How much did the appropriations bill have in for this?
My recollection is that although we cut the speaker's recommended program in half, what we're going to be doing is putting the amount that is in the fiscal note of the bill into the money end of it, because that maximizes cost effectiveness and keeps, as I had mentioned, keeps the hospital days down and keeps the flexibility in there. What we're hoping to do, since this is a technology that's rapidly improving, is because we have a centralized agency that is directly responsible for staying in touch with the national experts on this, as new and more effective and more cost-effective drugs come on the market, by having this all coordinated through one particular agency with expertise, we can more quickly respond. So that if, for example, a more effective and more cost-effective drug than AZT came online and was approved by the FDA, or got a 3-to-1 federal grant kind of match, we could more quickly respond to that kind of a purchase.
Are you saying the fiscal note's 13.8, it looks like, for this biennium? Is that what you're saying is in the appropriations bill to fund the grant program?
I believe so, but I'm not absolutely sure. I'd have to look at my, I just got the fiscal note 2 seconds before the committee started, and so I'd have to go back and look at the appropriations bill and see how it was broken down in the recommendations. But I know one thing, when they did the cut in the appropriations bill, they did not, as was unfortunately often the case, what occurred in the appropriations process is that there would be a motion to fund a program at a certain well-researched level. And if that passed, fine. And if it did not pass, the second motion was most often, and was in this case, half of whatever the recommendation was. Generally speaking, the people who made the motion to cut any funding did not do so with specificity. So unfortunately, it's sometimes a hatchet approach. But by leaving flexibility up to the department, what we'll be trying to do is the most cost-effective. In other words, appropriations didn't say we cut every single line item in this budget, in this department, by half. What they said was we cut the whole department appropriation by half, and then the department needs to make up what the difference is, and I guess face the music in sunset if they don't do a cost-effective job of it. Admittedly, it was not the most thoroughly thought-out way of cutting appropriations requests, but that's frankly the way it happened.
Any other questions, members? Ms. Stanberg, your bill regarding disclosure is where in the legislative process?
On the calendar.
Is it
the one on real estate?
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, there were alternative approaches to that issue. One was that the realtor be required to make disclosure. and alternatively that the realtor be prohibited from making disclosure. And your bill prohibits the realtor from making disclosure that the property was owned or rented by somebody who had AIDS, is that?
No, I don't know of any bill that required disclosure, and I don't know of any way of possibly any way enforcing that. What my bill is doing is addressing what the realtor's problem was, which is that they were, you know, it's damned if you do, damned if you don't, sued if you do, sued if you don't.
Well, I don't understand what you're saying, if you don't know of any way. I mean, is this different from a crack in the foundation that you're obligated to disclose? Is this different from any other kind of defect, that known defect in the property that you're obligated to disclose?
Quite different.
How's that?
Because the health of the previous owner is not a defect to the house.
Suppose it affects the market value of the house, and you're the purchaser, and the fact is widely known within the neighborhood, but you don't know it as purchaser, and that whether it should or should not affect the market value, it in fact does, that there is this perhaps unjustified fear or concern because of because the previous owner suffered from AIDS. Wouldn't that prospective purchaser be entitled to have information regarding the value, the effect on value that that disclosure might have?
I hate to be to answer a question with a question, but there are some people who think that houses are devalued by the racial status of the previous owner. Others think that houses are devalued because a person of some fame owned a house before. I mean, my sister, who worked for John Daugherty, was always asked by certain extremely wealthy people to sell her a no-name house because they didn't want Roy Hoffine's house or Carolyn Farb's house or some other famous individual's home. Since you can't catch AIDS from a house, I guess the realtors did not want, and what my bill does is it doesn't require any obligation and has no civil or criminal liability for inquiring, since it's simply not an issue.
The language, as you understand it, the language that is in your bill is incorporated in 1901?
No, the language that's in 1901 is the language that was originally in my bill. My bill has a committee substitute. The language in the original bill said that they were not to disclose. There could not be a lawsuit. What the language is in the committee substitute, there's no duty to inquire or disclose, and that there can't be a lawsuit or on civil or criminal level for failure to inquire or disclose, whatever.
So the realtor is not prohibited from disclosing, and the realtor is not obligated to disclose either way.
Right.
The realtor just incurs no liability. Is that about the size of it?
Right. It just kind of makes it instead of the original, quote, gag order, which some people had referred to it as, it makes it a no obligation. Now, certainly if anybody were to give knowingly false information, I'm sure that all the same old Deceptive Trade Practices Act stuff that applies to everything would come into play. But you see what the problem is, and this is totally off the bill before us, members, but I'll continue on this. Chair, what has been the case in some circumstances, and I'll just use one example here. There was a city council member here in Austin who was married to Miss Kitty, I can't remember what his name was, and, quote, everybody knew what he had and what he died from. Well, once he died, had my law not been in place, whoever bought the house could have sued if you didn't tell him he had AIDS. But if you did tell him he had AIDS, Miss Kitty could sue because he didn't. He died of pneumonia. So what we're basically saying is that since it's irrelevant as to the healthfulness of the environment, then there's no duty on anybody's part to discuss it at all, because that's not part of what you buy a house for or not.
the prospective purchaser then, if they want the information, can ask for it and the realtor can disclose it. If the prospective purchaser doesn't care one way or the other, then the realtor is not obligated to inform them.
If a purchaser asked the realtor and the realtor did not know, which would be the presumable situation, I'm sure the realtor would just say, I don't know. If the realtor knows something and makes intentional false remarks, I'm sure that it falls under deceptive trade practice like anything else. But this just simply made it so that they wouldn't have to take out the incredibly expensive classified ads that they were taking out because they cover their financial tail ends both ways and have protection from lawsuit.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Any other questions?
Sorry, the next bill that's before y'all. Okay, are there any other questions on 1113? Or on the other bill? Okay, House Bill 1708, which is before you. We don't have any expert witnesses, although any of the task force people who are here, I'm sure, can answer any questions that you have in addition to this. This is a bill that is designed to help people who are about to become eligible for Medicaid. This is a big money saver for the state. What it allows the state to do is to continue to pay their $100 a month, up to $100 per month, to continue private insurance, which they already have. In some cases, it'll be more expensive for the state, and they can waive doing so. But in many, many cases, being able to keep people on their private insurance, being able to keep them being able to go to the doctors of their choice and their private doctors, is a much less expensive burden for the state. But it's also a much more humane way to treat the patient and, of course, the doctor who's been caring for that person for quite a while and should not have to give up that patient to public hospitals in the middle of their treatment when that can be avoided. As you can tell, it's a lot more expensive for them to go on Medicaid and all of the other incumbent welfare circumstances than it would be to have the state pay $100 a month in many cases.
Are there any questions? Dr. Harris?
That's a standard that's used in lots and lots of legislation in Health and Human Services area.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. 200%.
If there's, I'll just refer to the task force folks and they can more specifically answer that. I've seen it before in Health and Human Services as a point of allusion, but they might have some more specific information as to how it's derived.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Willie?
Chairman, members, I'll be brief in that y'all are going to have a long night, I think, so I'll just try to keep it as short as possible. House Bill 1375 basically is dealing with the subject we're dealing with here, that within the Communicable Disease Prevention Control Act 4419B-1, it authorizes relief test results to specifically defined persons. There's basically eight different individuals, including the Department of Health and so on. House Bill 1375 basically amends that article to allow a public school classroom teacher, a certified classroom teacher, to receive the test results of a student under the teacher's supervision if the teacher meets the criteria relating to the release of the test result. In the omnibus bill under Section 9, basically it addresses in part under Section 9, page 27 of the omnibus bill, it addresses in part the need to know for a teacher, basically stating that they must have in-service training dealing with that subject. Basically, 1375, House Bill 1375 amends that article to add that if the teacher has the proper medical advice from a licensed medical from a legal a person with legal background, be able to tell them what they can do and what they can't do. In other words, must be briefed thoroughly by a licensed attorney and someone with medical background. It also amends Section 2 by adding subdivision to define be a certified classroom teacher, a full-time classroom teacher, not including a teacher employed by a school district less than 6 weeks, hired to replace on a temporary basis full-time teacher. There will be four witnesses in this regard that I've also asked them to be brief in their testimony when their time comes. Implication that was brought out by the budget board, but there would be some, at some point in time, there would be additional cost to the school district and to the state on the in-service training, if whether it be in the omnibus bill or whether it be in this bill. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer.
Are there any questions, members? Thank you very much. Blackwood.
Mr. Chairman, current statutes provide that emergency medical service personnel, such as police officers, paramedics, shall be notified of a positive test result from any reportable disease listed in the Texas Board of Health guidelines. However, the current statutes do not provide for any penalties if this procedure is not followed. It has been noted that many cities and hospitals, for whatever reason, doctor confidentiality or whatever, do not follow this procedure, and see that notification is made to the police officer, the paramedic, the firefighters who has possibly been infected by the disease or exposed to it. House Bill 2022 requires that an incentive provides for incentive to these individuals, these entities, to comply with the law by allowing that the injured public employee may sue for damages, or in addition to that, the court may impose civil penalties not to exceed $1,000 against the entity, whether it be the hospital or the city, failed to follow the procedure in reporting the exposure to this disease.
Any questions, members? Thank you very much, Mr. Blackwood. Obard? Okay. Come on, Harley.
This is HB 2026 by Representative Ovard, and he has some witnesses here that can speak more specifically about it, but basically this just exempts employers from the bona fide occupational qualification section of the current law.
Any questions? Mr. Madler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2128, as you know, currently physicians are authorized to release the results of an AIDS test to the spouse of the individual tested. House Bill 2128 would require that the spouse be notified by that physician by name or person. House Bill 2129 merely includes under the chronically ill and disabled children's program administered by the Department of Health. It authorizes them to include children who are infected with AIDS. I point out that there's a substitute that is being prepared to cap that particular program at $1.5 million, which is the amount of money that the subcommittee or the committee recommended that the Appropriations Committee be spent for that particular program, and is the amount of dollars that are currently in the appropriation bill.
Any questions, Mr. Madlin?
Pardon? I'm finished. I have. Not before the committee. We have all the
bills. No, we're not going to take up your other bills at this time, Mr. Madlin.
I was just trying, Mr. Chairman.
Did Mr. Rep already discuss 2213? He did. Can tell what a lasting impression that made.
No, I think he did. It's a blue card.
Mr. Campbell?
Oh, did he do it? Close up?
Mr. Clemens, did you already do 2357?
Yeah.
Okay. Ms. McDonald, are you going to handle 2426 for Mr. Carter? Okay.
Basically, this is a lot like Representative Clemens' bill. But
any questions?
Follows the language somewhat the same.
He's not here. Before we get started, let me again request that the testimony be brief and not be redundant. Chris Steele, leave the chamber for a minute.
to the other thing.
Chairman Wright, did you just call on me?
Yes. Let me ask that everyone who intends to testify today please stand and raise your right hands. Do you solemnly swear that testimony you'll give today is the whole truth, so help you God? Would you please state your name and who you represent?
Right, members of the Public Health Committee, I'm the Reverend Chris C. Steele. I'm an Episcopal priest in the Diocese of Texas, and I reside in Houston. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 1901, the HIV Omnibus Bill, and House Bill 1069, relating to anti-discrimination, sponsored by Representative Guerrero. From October 1987 until January 1989, I had the privilege of chairing the Legislative Task Force on AIDS. That was a 19-member panel with the Commissioner of Health ex officio, comprised of private citizens and legislators who were appointed by Lieutenant Governor Hobby and Speaker Lewis for their expertise in a wide range of health, finance, legal, and legislative issues. It is noteworthy, Mr. Chairman, that the sponsor of House Bill 1901, Representative Mike McKinney, was among the physicians who served on the task force, and two of your committee members, Representatives Nancy McDonald and Billy Clemens, also serve very well and actively and are co-sponsors of 1901. The charge given to the task force was to study the current and projected impact of AIDS and HIV infection with special attention to the economic burden it has imposed and unchecked will continue to impose on our state, and of course to present our findings and recommendations to this 71st legislative session. We have accomplished this through the release of our final report, which presumably has reached the office of every legislator. It's entitled AIDS in Texas Facing the Crisis. The task force directly benefited from the timely release of a number of authoritative initiatives on AIDS and HIV by our national leadership, including the Surgeon General's report, the report of the Presidential Commission on HIV, the HIV policy of the American Medical Association, and most recently, passage of the Omnibus Health Act by Congress last October. And I am able to say with confidence that our findings and recommendations are squarely placed in the mainstream of the best public health wisdom and guidance available in the country. Together, these findings and recommendations constitute not the last word, but an initial strategy by which Texas can at last face this crisis. What we discovered in the course of extensive research, and I won't describe to you what all those studies involved, but I'd be glad to on your questioning, on numerous site visits and dozens of meetings and public hearings throughout this state, what we observed defies description. In short, we unearthed a veritable nightmare on every front, the most tragic being the toll of suffering on the lives of thousands upon thousands of men, women, and children in Texas. Thanks to Dr. Palmer Beasley, the Dean of the School of Public Health of the University of Texas, his faculty, and the Texas Department of Health, we have sound epidemiologic information contained in the final report, which provides us with the first reliable database ever in the history of this epidemic. And with your indulgence, I'd like to offer a brief review, since Dr. Beasley couldn't be here, of the statistics that were developed as part of the work of the task force. You should all have a set of charts, just a simple collection here, to which you will want to refer at this point. You can see from your figure one that AIDS is truly epidemic in Texas. By 1987, we were already losing more people to this disease in 1 year than we had diagnosed cases of 2 years before in 1985. During the course of the task force 12-month study, an additional 2,000 Texans were diagnosed with AIDS. As of April 14th, just last Friday, 6,460 Texans have been diagnosed since 1980. By any count, the disease is not abating. Our estimates indicate that by 1992, as many as 45,000 Texans will have been diagnosed with AIDS, a number comparable to the total battle deaths of American forces in Vietnam. By 1992, at the end of the next biennium, 1 in 10 Americans with AIDS will be a Texan. You know, there is very little, if anything, that we can do to forestall the numbers of individuals with AIDS by 1992 due to the latency period that this virus causes. Most likely, the Texans who will be diagnosed with AIDS between now and then are among the approximately 100,000 people already infected with HIV in this state. Since there is little we can do about the 1992 numbers, the task is to control the long-term spread of the virus and to deal most effectively with the myriad of problems and needs that will inevitably arise. Your figure 2, the pyramid-shaped graph, illustrates why we are often misled by looking only at the numbers of persons actually diagnosed with AIDS. These numbers represent only the tip of the iceberg. We have to remember that at any one time, there are many more Texans with HIV-related illness than are reflected in the numbers of cases of people reported to be living with full-blown AIDS. There are, as you know, a few areas of the state that are as hard hit as any region in this country. Houston leads 45 states in the number of people with AIDS. AIDS is the leading cause of death in Houston for men between the ages of 25 and 44. Dallas surpasses 42 states in the number of reported AIDS cases. San Antonio and Austin round out the hardest hit areas in our state. The AIDS epidemic in this state is not simply an urban problem either. More than half of Texas' 254 mostly rural counties have reported cases of AIDS. We know of many Texans who are ill with AIDS that have moved home to rural areas from urban Texas or from other states to be near their family in their time of need. Your figures 3 and 4 show the dramatic spread of the epidemic across the state. In figure 3, from 1980 to 1982, you can see that only 39 counties were affected. By 1988, in figure 4, the entire state is colored in with 138 counties reporting cases. Remember, these are full-blown cases of AIDS. We've also seen that the ability and resources necessary to respond to AIDS-related service needs varies greatly across the state, and there are needs everywhere in Texas as a result of what amounts to a true crisis. Several aspects of House Bill 1901 address these needs. First and foremost, we can target educational efforts to those groups that we can reasonably assume to be at risk of transmission, especially those without access to mainstream media. Many ethnic and racial minorities, women, the drug-dependent population, adolescents, and homosexual men. Remember that education is the only vaccine we have, and it works. Secondly, the bill calls for additional studies designed to identify HIV transmission trends in various populations. Thirdly, 1901 calls for a state grant program that would provide volunteers and nonprofit community-based organizations with essential funding to enhance HIV-related services. Community-based organizations have been, and to this day, remain the backbone of Texas' struggle to care for those who are sick and dying from this disease. The state must continue to marshal and to assist and to sustain these selfless and really heroic resources, which are without exception woefully underfunded and overextended. And yet these community-based organizations and the continuum of health and social services that they provide offer the only feasible alternatives, costly last-minute acute care hospitalization. Fourthly, I want to underscore the bill's provisions for an HIV medication grant program. Representative Danberg has spoken to her bill. You, who served on the task force, know that among the most lamentable aspects of the HIV disease, aside from human suffering, is the extraordinarily high cost for what few drugs exist for the treatment of opportunistic infections. It makes good economic sense for our state, through the Department of Health, to invest in medications which will keep people alive longer, productive in the workforce, paying taxes, and out of expensive hospital settings. The hallmark of the HIV medication grant program is that it would allow local hospital districts, public and nonprofit hospitals, and community-based providers to pool money for the bulk purchase of these expensive drugs and to use local money as the match for federal dollars. Finally, 1901 calls for state agencies and their contractors to provide model workplace guidelines. The state can and must assume an important and exemplary role for private industry in assuring that all state and state agency employees and their contractors are fully educated about HIV transmission and workplace policies regarding the fair and confidential treatment of those who may have an HIV diagnosis. A great number of discrimination cases occur in the workplace. Unfair treatment of an employee with AIDS or HIV is expensive in many ways, including potential financial loss to the state due to liability claims. Any review of AIDS legislation across the country reveals a mixed record. Bad legislation, motivated by the tactics of fear and prejudice and lack of education about HIV and its modes of transmission, can seriously inhibit public health efforts and educational campaigns aimed at curbing this epidemic. Good legislation can make a rich and decisive contribution to health efforts. In an era in which science and technology have been invoked with almost blind confidence, we have little immediate help from drugs or vaccines, but we do have abundant and detailed knowledge about this microbe we call HIV. The challenge to policymakers is to respond without panic and without resort to extreme measures. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 1901 is good legislation. It provides your committee, as it could provide all legislators, with the opportunity for rational and effective leadership, with the ever-present caveat that positive action must be taken now. You have heard the numbers. By the next legislative session, in 2 years' time, the cumulative total of those dead or suffering from full-blown AIDS will have increased from the present 6,460 to at least 30,000. My own personal and professional experience as a spokesperson for and advocate of sound public policy and social policy with respect to the AIDS crisis in our state, I encourage this committee to give House Bill 1901 the favorable and expedient consideration it deserves. Before commenting on Bill 1069, I will certainly answer any questions.
Mrs. Schoolcraft?
I believe you gave us this handout with the statistics, didn't you?
Yes, I think those are county by county statistics.
By county, correct.
Yeah, I don't have that in front of me, but I'm familiar with what you're talking about.
Well, I noticed there's a date on it, April 7th, and is that when these numbers? There's a 1989 column. I guess what I'm asking is how current is this information for 89?
Okay, what you have here is data from Friday, April 7th. The Department of Health does its update every Friday. So I gave you even more current numbers with respect to the 6460 cumulative total. Does that answer your question?
Well, that's leading into my question. I'm looking down at the statewide results, and I see in 1987 you showed 1,956 new cases, and in 88 you showed 1,785, which is a decrease. And then I took the 1989 figures of 228, multiplied it times 4, because that covered about the first 3 months, and that comes out to a total of about 912. So it looks to me like there's a pretty steep trend downward on new cases now. That's the first time I've seen anything like that.
I'm afraid I can't explain this, but I would like to call on or ask someone to call on a member of the Department of Health AIDS Bureau who are here today to speak to this. These are their data.
Well, we can call them as resource witnesses at some point, but we want to...
But I'm sorry, I can't account for these discrepancies here.
Any other questions, members? Did you want to discuss
I
any
did,
other...
I did, sir. One of the most... the only real omission in 1901 that establishes a discrepancy between that bill and the Legislative Task Force priority recommendations is the rather conspicuous omission of anti-discrimination provisions. I'm satisfied with the explanations I've given by the sponsors as to why that's not there, but I think it's a good opportunity, it's certainly timely for me to speak in favor of House Bill 1069, sponsored by Representative Guerrero. There is a formidable consensus among all public health and legal experts that I've heard from or read of or talked to that anti-discrimination is the cornerstone of any strategy to contain this epidemic. Wrongly and very, very unfortunately, there is an equation in the minds of too many that anti-discrimination in this context means gay rights, and I'm here to say it's otherwise. Admiral James Watkins, who was the former chairman of the Presidential Commission on the HIV epidemic and now Secretary of Energy, is not a gay rights activist. Yet he and his commission issued the following recommendation to President Reagan. Quote, HIV-related discrimination is impairing the nation's ability to limit the spread of the epidemic. Public health officials will not be able to gain the confidence and cooperation of infected individuals or those at high risk for infection if such individuals fear that they will be unable to retain their jobs and their housing, and that they will be unable to obtain the medical and support services they need because of discrimination based on a positive HIV antibody test. This fear of potential discrimination will limit the public's willingness to comply with the collection of epidemiologic data and other public health strategies, will undermine our efforts to contain the epidemic, and will leave HIV-infected individuals isolated and alone, close quote. President Reagan, responding to his own commission's call for federal anti-discrimination legislation, called instead upon society to, quote, respond equitably and compassionately to those with HIV infection and to their families, close quote. But in the absence of federal legislation, it is now left up to individual states to implement the Commission's anti-discrimination recommendations. The Legislative Task Force on AIDS has determined that discrimination is rampant in Texas, and it lies at the root of many of the obstacles associated with controlling the HIV epidemic in this state. Remember that discrimination has economic as well as public health consequences. When people lose their income and resources, they lose their financial independence and turn to public welfare programs for assistance. It really is that simple. Similarly, the task force determined that fear of discrimination causes people to avoid counseling and testing, thereby increasing the possibility of further HIV transmission. In Texas, discrimination has occurred against a variety of people with HIV infection as well as their caregivers. For example, and here Representative Clemens is an illustration of perceived AIDS. You may recall at the hearing in Dallas when we learned about a grandmother who later lost her job when her employer learned that she was the sole caregiver of a 3-year-old granddaughter who had AIDS. This employer did not need to consult the medical records of either the child or the woman, but perceived that by association, the woman, the grandmother of the HIV-infected infants, had AIDS. The woman therefore lost her job. The wife of a hemophiliac with HIV was fired from her job when she told her employer that she had AIDS. We've already heard from Representative Guerrero, and I won't repeat the data that she provided you that comes from our report that has startling evidence about the percent of those with AIDS who have reported loss of jobs, loss of housing, and rejection from their homes and by their families. It is surely a vital function of public health law to protect people, all people, from the loss of their homes, jobs, treatment, education, and other benefits because that person harbors a virus. And so I urge you to support Representative Guerrero's House Bill 1069. And that concludes my remarks. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Mr. Rodriguez?
Let me ask you, I'm just curious, do we have any feel for example, the number of deaths that occur of individuals with AIDS that maybe some other cause of death might be reported?
Could you expand a little on your question?
Example, I know for some cases in, where certain particular death you know, was reported as being something else, yet there was AIDS. Do you have any
I believe that there are people here who are resource witnesses with the Department of Health who, of course, receive the reporting data who can give you some information on that. I know of cases where that's happened, but it wouldn't, you know, my knowledge would simply be happenstance. There certainly are situations like that. You mean another name than HIV or an HIV-related illness given for the record? I'm sure someone else can answer that question.
Mr. Clemens?
Since we're on this subject, you say discrimination discourages people from coming in and for testing and counseling. And, of course, early intervention is the best way to treat the disease, isn't that right? And that what we've heard, early intervention is...
I think there's a strong consensus that earlier intervention can provide the treatment that will prolong and enhance life.
Mm-hmm. So who most directly benefits from being tested and counseled?
I think everyone does.
But most directly, isn't that the patient's benefit so that they can get the early intervention?
Well, I really have to remain with my response, Billy, excuse me, Representative Clemens. Everyone benefits. The person knows their status and will, if everything else is intact, be subject to the state-of-the-art counseling that always must accompany testing, and therefore behavior modification is an expected result of that, which of course can only benefit other people as well as that person in terms of possible transmission of the virus.
Well, I agree with that. But
so I think it's across the board, but certainly the person with the diagnosis will also benefit, yes.
So that they can get the early intervention. But so the way I'm seeing it is people are coming and saying, all right, we want you to test us and counsel us and give us treatment and give us AZT and for you to have the benefit of doing that for us, you're also going to have to give us anti-discrimination. It looks to me like they'd be coming with a hat in their hand and saying, if you'll take care of us, we'll cooperate with you in every way we can to help you stamp out this disease by partner notification, contact tracing, and hopefully... And not hopefully, but definitely, the state would take the role of educating the citizens, just as we did with TB years ago, and other unknown diseases, polio and so on, where people were discriminated against at first until they began to understand the disease, and that this discrimination thing would evolve in such a way that people would be able to handle it.
Well, I think I understand what you're getting at. First of all, Billy, remember what you know perfectly well. That is, we're not just dealing with a disease that has a stigma like cancer or TB or polio in the past. We're dealing with a disease that has a triple cultural taboo, sex and drugs and death, and behaviors related, okay, to at least two out of those three. That introduces a reaction. I'm no psychologist, but I certainly have lived and observed long enough to know that the kind of taboo, or excuse me, stigma, that we associate with AIDS stems from some much deeper fears, okay? Even more irrational in the case of a disease that is not, thank God, airborne, that is not, thank God, casually transmitted. Nevertheless, it does provoke those fears. Anti-discrimination is being called for most vocally by the public health experts who are saying this is a central means of controlling the epidemic.
And as a matter
so
of fact,
it's not a special interest measure. It certainly isn't, as the task force has made its recommendations, it certainly isn't, according to the various national authoritative initiatives that I cited, including the Presidential Commission's report and the AMA and others. And it's not a special interest. This is a public health measure. We can argue away about it, but I think I understand what you're getting at. It may appear to be unreasonable given some of the behavioral associations that we have with the transmission of the disease. But the fact remains, and I'm convinced of it myself, that we are not going to control the spread of this epidemic without protections allowing people with HIV to be defined as other people with disabilities are, so they can at least safely avail themselves the very kinds of services we want them to avail themselves for.
You mentioned that this disease does not have this, or that the diseases, polio, TB, and other diseases in past years where there was discrimination, did not have the stigma that this has now. And I hold to you that one of the reasons this disease is being dealt with the way it is because those diseases in the past did not deal predominantly with homosexuals the way this one does. And I believe that puts it into the political arena.
I don't question that for a minute, but I will say that for people to have to pay with their lives because of a stigma is somewhat inhumane for any society.
I agree, but I'm saying that we will get over this the way we got over the discrimination of the other diseases.
But I personally hope you're right. I'm not sure it's going to happen unless we take a much more active stance with respect to anti-discrimination. It's just not going to happen by itself. It's going to take leadership.
But there was a poll distributed in all our offices week before last that said that showed that in Texas people are overcoming discrimination. And it's partly because so many families now have someone that they know or is in their family who is touched directly by the disease. But I think the signs are showing definitely that we're overcoming it.
Well, I'd like to think so. I hope it doesn't become like the animal rights movement where everyone had to lose a pet before they really, you know, got on board here. If it gets to the point where we all have to lose a member of our family or a loved one, it's too late. With all due respect, Billy.
Well, I don't even want to get started in the animal rights discussion, but
we'll have it over venison.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Billy.
Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
I'm out of shot.
Robert Feldman.
No,
it's not. I don't
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak about this issue. My name is Robert Feldman. I'm a cardiovascular surgeon in the private practice of surgery in Houston, Texas. And I hope that I am not going to repeat anything that's been said. AIDS does represent a serious threat not only to the health of Texas citizens, but also a threat to the taxpayer in terms of ever-increasing costs of this disease. Section 5.04 of this bill would amend Article 9 of the Communicable Disease Prevention and Control Act by adding Section 9.07. I feel the wording of this section still is too protective of those patients harboring this deadly virus and too cumbersome for doctors in Texas to deal with as written. Infectious, communicable disease and should be dealt with as such. We have no special protection for the confidentiality of patients with strep throat, measles, or tuberculosis. Why should AIDS patients be any different? The purpose of the Texas Department of Health is to prevent the spread of disease and, when possible, treat disease. While AIDS is not curable, its spread should be checked by proper identification through blood testing, spousal or partner notification, and contact tracing. Anything less than that is sticking our head in the sand. A blood test for AIDS should be no different from a blood test for syphilis or sickle cell disease. It should be no different from a sputum culture for TB or a culture for gonorrhea. Doctors in Texas should be allowed to test for AIDS upon admission to the hospital with the general informed consent which all patients sign. This general informed consent allows for blood testing, x-rays, and other diagnostic procedures, which should include AIDS. Doctors should not have to be burdened with a task of, quote, AIDS counseling, unquote, every single patient admitted or every single patient in whom AIDS blood testing is performed. Certainly, if the test returns positive, then counseling is in order, as we would do for any other positive test, whether it be for TB, diabetes, or any other abnormality. As a heart surgeon, my surgical team is exposed to blood from patients on a daily basis. While we endeavor to follow universal precautions as per OSHA guidelines, I feel it is my duty to allow all members of the surgical team to be aware of the status of the blood of the patients we are operating upon. Additionally, we need to know the AIDS status because major cardiovascular surgery may be very hazardous in terms of infection in the patient who is HIV positive, but otherwise asymptomatic as relates their HIV infection. Yes, I do operate upon and care for AIDS patients. If a patient has a positive HIV test, we would probably manage our antibiotic coverage differently, as well as screen our blood differently. For example, attempt to use negative CMV or cytomegalous blood in the patient who is going to get a transfusion. If a patient is HIV positive, those operating room nurses who are pregnant have the right to work in a different room and not be exposed to the HIV positive blood and secretions. The effect of extra counseling and special informed consent, which we have been working under, has caused the number of AIDS blood tests in one hospital in Houston to drop from 30 per week to 2 or 3 per week. This is hardly what any scientist or doctor would want in an epidemic. That's a reduction of data input. We need to increase testing, not decrease it. In fact, I have for the committee's review something I got in the mail just today from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, a newsletter which addresses increasing the testing for AIDS in patients undergoing thoracic or heart surgery. I respectfully request that the legislature remove any provisions which would inhibit testing for AIDS. Let it be tested like any other infectious communicable disease. Require the Texas Department of Health to notify spouse and or partners and perform contact tracing. Remove any burdensome confidentiality language. Medical records are already confidential, and as such, the healthcare industry cannot just turn over data to anyone. The patient must give consent to turn over records. Why burden hospitals with constructing special locked file rooms to handle stacks of records just because one test, the AIDS test, was done, even when it's negative? Texas doctors and Texas hospitals want to get rid of these burdensome regulations which are hampering quality health care in Texas. Finally, I am concerned about Texas taxpayer dollars. The regulations outlined in the Omnibus AIDS Bill will call for the expenditure of tremendous sums of money just to support an ever-growing bureaucracy at the Texas Department of Health. It is time to let the 1,000 points of light shine forth, as described by fellow Houstonian President George Bush. We don't need to spend more taxpayer dollars. We need more volunteers to help take care of these poor, unfortunate souls, most of whom have been infected through illegal activities in the past.
There'll be no demonstrations, please. Dr. Feltman, the informed consent that you have to have now, is that a rule of your hospital, the state, through an agency, or through statute?
I believe that it is a statute that was passed at the last legislative session. In fact, in our hospital, we have had our lawyers check into that, and they will not let a blood test for AIDS be drawn on a patient unless the doctor, who is the attending physician, has gone to that patient, counseled with the patient, and taken with them a special informed consent form, which was signed not only by the patient, but by the doctor.
What happens if that consent form does get in the wrong hands? Is there a new level of liability?
The consent form?
Yes. You have to keep it under special lock and key?
In our hospital, anytime a blood test result, not the consent form, anytime blood test result, whether it be negative or positive, is put on a hospital chart, that chart is stamped confidential and locked up in a special file.
Members, do you have any questions for Dr. Feltman?
I do.
Ms. McDonald?
You test all your patients that you perform surgery on for AIDS.
I used to do that before September the 1st when that bill became law, but now I can't sometimes sit down and spend the time that it takes to get the counseling done and get the informed consent form signed. So occasionally I do not test, but I attempt to test everybody that I'm going to do heart surgery on or use blood on. And in fact, that is the standard as outlined by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons across the country.
Well, if I don't suppose you've seen a copy of the substitute for 1901, but we do say in this statute that consent need not be written if there's documentation in the medical record that the test has been explained and consent obtained. So I think it certainly would make it easy for you. And I do feel that it is not by statute that your hospital has designed the other written consent, because that was more hospitals have overreacted to the statute that was passed. But if that is a practice, I can understand your concern. But what we're looking at in this legislation in 1901 is a simple consent that could be noted in a medical record if explained to the patient face-to-face, and it need not be written. And if you are doing that, my question to you is that overburdensome?
That is overburdensome, because I would feel then that I should explain to the patient why I was doing a VDRL test for syphilis or a sickle cell test for sickle cell anemia. I mean, this is the first disease or the first blood test that has come along in American medicine that legislators have told us doctors how to practice medicine, when to order a blood test. I think we should be allowed to order a blood test if we want to protect that patient against disease. And the one reason that I believe that is when we do heart surgery on a patient, the cardiopulmonary bypass machine does affect immunity. And there is some data that is coming out that doing heart surgery on a patient who's asymptomatic HIV positive and may not have AIDS may rapidly accelerate their disease process to the AIDS stage. Again, from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons.
Well, I don't think we're telling you that you must do the test.
I think we
actually
should.
It's been a concern of consumers for years that they understand what test any doctor is ordering for them, and the same of insurance companies who have constantly been on the side of consumers in simply asking the doctors why test any lab test is ordered. So I consider this in line with all the other things that, for instance, I know it might not be as important why a BDRL is ordered, but I feel a patient does have a need to know if they ask for that information.
Mr. Rodriguez?
Let me ask you, doctor, you used the word illegal. Do you have any idea as to how many youngsters have AIDS now?
I think that number is very small, but what I do know is that the number of patients in Texas that have AIDS, over 90% of them are either homosexuals and or IV drug abusers. Both of those activities are illegal in the state of Texas.
You also mentioned your concern in terms of the taxpayer dollars. Do you have any indication as to how much the state is expending in this area already?
I have no idea.
Does that also indicate that that you would not be in favor of some of the bills that are before us that deal with allocating some resources in that specific area?
I would oppose that because, well, I would oppose that. You want me to expand on why? Well, I think that there are many other disease processes in the state which are being overlooked while AIDS is being funded. For example, if you look at the pure numbers, as Reverend Steele did earlier, there's 1.5 million HIV-positive people in the United States. That's what the CDC says. There are 14 million Texans in the state of Texas. There are 200 million Americans. That means if you work all those figures out, there's 105,000 people in the state of Texas that may be HIV-positive. If you look at the number of people who have died in Texas, it's infinitesimally small as compared to heart disease, diabetes, or cancer. And I think it's wrong to subsidize just one disease entity when other people are dying and suffering of other diseases.
The committee can correct me. My understanding is that last year we allocated $3 million, and that's all the state is giving.
Well, that's up to the legislature to do. You know, maybe my opinion might be that might be too much. Fact is, AIDS deaths in Texas represent less than, I would say, 1% of the deaths in Texas.
But Dr. Feltman, what about the fact that the curve is going so fastly up, whereas we've leveled off to a certain extent on heart disease and cancer and other things, but you know, the upward curve for AIDS is climbing so fast that you can easily see at the same rate we're going to have a lot of AIDS cases by the turn of the century.
Well, I would address it as they come along. They're not here yet. I think education is proper. What we should do is stop people from practicing sodomy, which is illegal in Texas, and we should stop people from using IV drugs, which is illegal in Texas. That's a law enforcement problem.
Any other questions? Let me ask you one more before I let you go here. Is there any problem with the confidentiality in the medical profession now?
In terms of other diseases?
Yeah.
Well,
breach of confidence?
We never release records unless the patient gives written consent to do so. And in doing so would be breaching confidentiality. And I have no judicial records about doctors being sued for improper release of records, but that is certainly against the law to release records without the patient giving consent, whether they have an AIDS test or not, whether they just have a throat culture or a sputum culture.
Okay. Ms. McDonald?
One more question. Dr. Feldman, would you be able to release the results of an HIV test if it were positive to the spouse or sexual partner of one of your patients without permission from that?
At this point in time?
Well, I'd say if we had no laws concerning this, what would you do? Because we've heard different testimony from doctors. I'm just asking you as an individual. Would you feel like you could do that?
My impression would be not without the patient's permission.
And if we made it the law so that you could do it without the permission, would you do it in that case?
Absolutely. Just the same as if the patient had syphilis, I think his wife should know about that.
Is that all? Thank you, Dr. Feldman.
Thank you very much.
There's been a request to have a resource witness and from the Department of Health, so we're going to put Christy, we're going to call you to come up before these other witnesses. The chair calls Christy Reed from the Department of Health.
Do we have any affirmation? Christy Reed.
Ms. Reed is here as a resource witness from the Department of Health.
Good evening.
Just go ahead and state your name for the tape recorder.
I'm the AIDS Division Director for the Texas Department of Health.
And Mr. Schoolcraft has a question.
Christy, I don't know if you heard my question last, but I'm looking at your weekly report, and I was looking at the state total. And I guess that's new cases for each year, and I see a drop from 87 to 88. And then when I multiplied 89 out, it looked like an even larger drop. Can you tell me what the trend is looking like?
There's a time lag between a case being diagnosed, being reported to the local level, and making it up to our level. So there's always a time lag built in. We won't be done collecting 1987 cases probably till next year. And so we won't be done collecting 1988 cases longer after that.
On diagnosis, it takes 2 years to get to you?
Sometimes it does. It takes a long time, or if an area has not been reporting or personnel changeover, the person who was doing that job leaves and the next person doesn't start up. We're constantly going back and validating systems to make sure that they're all being reported.
Someone mentioned to me the curve in San Francisco. Do you know what's happening there as far as what the trend is?
The latest I saw is that the average incubation period now, that's a period between exposure and development of symptoms, is increased now to 10 years. People who were infected over 10 years ago now are showing up as cases.
Okay, but as far as total number of cases, growth or decrease from year to year, what's happening there?
I haven't looked recently from year to year, but I think it's maintaining. The new infections rate went down in 83 related to education campaigns, but I'm not sure the cases have fallen off yet.
Why is this reporting taking so long?
Sometimes a patient may be seen and not all the test work done. Sometimes they realize now that that might have been what it is and go back and do some diagnostic tests. It's a labor intensive. On a lot of other conditions, measles, all you have to do is look at somebody's spots and say, okay, this is measles. In these cases, we all use cases that meet the same definition. And so sometimes it's a change. They need to do more laboratory tests to actually confirm it.